Hello and welcome to the America Magazine podcast for the week of February 13th. This week we feature a conversation from our archives with Professor Richard Gagliardi, now of Boston College. He gave a talk at the LA Religious Education Congress in 2010 entitled, Do We Need a Vatican III? In the most recent issue of America, Professor Gagliardi looks at Vatican II as we celebrate the 50th anniversary of the convocation of the Council. I began my conversation with Professor Gagliardi by asking him to list some of the many successes of Vatican II.
Well, I mean, there's so many things that there's a risk of leaving some things out. So let me just, we'll focus on a few things that I think are particularly important. First of all, I think there was a pretty profound reimagining of what it was to be church that involved going back and retrieving more theological, biblical, sacramental images of the church that focused much more on baptism and Eucharist as the foundations of the church, and the full adult participation of all the faithful in the life of the church. And so you get what's often called, and I think I have some misgivings about this, but people often speak of this in terms of the theology of the laity. And it's undeniable that if you look at the life of the church today, I mean, there is an affirmation of the role of the laity that it can only be seen as a tremendous gift, a genuine advance over the dominant kind of theological understanding before the council. And it's borne fruit in terms of, you know, participation in lay ministry, the work of pastoral councils at parish level, and so on. I have some misgivings about it because I think in many ways what the council really was trying to develop was less a theology of the laity than a theology of baptism. But either way, what we're talking about is an attempt to move beyond a kind of sterile, clerical view of the church to a more robust understanding of the church as the body of Christ and people of God. That theological vision, you know, the fact that people no longer primarily think of, when they say church, think of the hierarchy, is a great fruit of the council and not something to be taken lightly. And in fact, even if you think about the silver lining, if there was a silver lining in the clerical sexual abuse scandal, and I'm still not sure there was, it's this, from my point of view, that so few people left. I thought a lot more people would leave in anger over it. Now, some did, by the way. But I would like to think that the reason that so many didn't leave is because they had a sense of, doggone it, this is our church. And they're going to hold the bishops and the clergy accountable, but they're not going to give it over. And so it suggests a genuine sense of ownership that I think is a great gift to the council and has to be seen as one of the great success stories of the implementation of the council.
And some of the other success stories that you mentioned in your talk, which I just attended, was the liturgical reform, which, you know, you could see that definitely a success, introduction of the vernacular. Maybe later we'll address some of perhaps disappointments with that, and also dialogical approach to other religions. Maybe we can move on to talk about some of maybe the disappointments or areas for improvement in terms of the implementation of the council. And one is the whole area of collegiality, which, as you said, was one of the most talked about controversial topics.
Well, right. See, here's maybe a way of talking about this is you could think of the reception of the council at two levels. On the one hand, the council gave us a very different language for thinking and talking about the church. The Jesuit church historian John O'Malley, in his book, What Happened at Vatican II, really emphasizes this. He focuses on the rhetorical shift that took place at the council, not just in terms of the reappropriation of a more biblical and patristic vision of the church, but the emphasis on language of participation, cooperation, partnership, and dialogue. So on the one level, we can think of what the council gave us in terms of a theological and ecclesial vision. But look, vision ultimately has to become concretized in structure, in practices and habits of behavior. And it's at this level, at the level of more structural or institutional implementation, that I think many people in the church would voice some disappointment. And you can see it at multiple levels. So if, as I suggested in my talk, the church is teaching on collegiality, that the bishops share with the Bishop of Rome in pastoral oversight of the entire church, if that was a great gift of the council, when we look at the concrete mechanisms for collegiality that have emerged in the wake of the council, principally synod of bishops, the role of episcopal conferences, there's a lot of room for disappointment that these institutions are not doing what I think many of the bishops and periti at the council hoped would emerge out of the council.
One was the Synod of Bishops, which is held every 3 years, but it is more of a consultative body than a deliberative one.
Well, right. It's held every 3 years unless there's an extraordinary synod, and then they can be held more frequently. The question about who's invited, I mean, to some extent, they're presidents of bishops' conferences, but the Vatican still has some control over who can be invited. The Vatican has a great deal of control over what the agenda is. And most disappointingly, after the, I think it was the 1971 synod, for complicated reasons, synods stopped issuing their own final documents and instead deferred to the Pope, which is a little bit difficult because they have no control over how seriously the Pope's going to take their propositions. And there's simply a lot of structural problems with the synod that would have to be investigated. And it's important to recognize, and this is the larger point, how far the synod, as we see it now, is from what I think many of the bishops of the council had in mind, where people like Archbishop Alfrink and Patriarch, the Melkite Patriarch Maximus the Saig, they were proposing something more in the Eastern model of a standing body of bishops with deliberative authority. I mean, this is nowhere close to that. So at that level, it seems to me there's a real obvious example of a failure of implementation. The other example that I mentioned has to do with the Code of Canon Law. Now, you know, I want to be careful. I don't want to be overly critical of the Code of Canon Law. It's certainly a tremendous improvement over the 1917 Code. But here again, there were major flaws in terms of implementation. The commission concerned with the revision of the Code was told, the subcommittees were told, they had to start with the pertinent canons from the 1917 Code. That put a real straitjacket on what the Council should do. In many cases, they proof-texted from the Council. They quote documents. But if you look at the code, one could legitimately question whether it consistently captured the larger vision of the council. And as I suggested in my talk, a great example of this is Book 2 in the Code of Canon Law on the People of God, which, although it cites much of the council's teaching, there are important lacunae. And the two that I mentioned are a failure to give any really developed consideration of the biblical notion of charism that emerged in the council documents that played an important role, and also the role of the faithful, the sense of the faithful. There's a weak pneumatology, period, in the Code of Canon Law. Very little consideration of structures that might become instruments for the work of the Spirit. So, you know, when you look at how you're going to make the teaching of the Council a reality, I mean, the Code of Canon Law is really important. I mean, this is the codification of the vision. And I think, frankly, a lot of canonists would tell you, in important ways, it falls tragically short of the vision the council was offering us.
And one suggestion you made in your talk was that perhaps it was done too quickly. I mean, it was 1983 is when it was promulgated, but perhaps they went into the work right after the council.
They did. They went into the work right after the council. Many of the scholars were themselves primarily trained and formed in a tradition of canon law prior to the Second Vatican Council. Now, obviously, many of them, you know, embraced the vision of the council, but It's not simply a question of desire. You know, I think they wanted to implement the vision of the council. But look, I think we're 40 years removed from the council, more than 40 years removed from the council. And I think we're just now getting sufficient distance to be able to really benefit from the first-rate historical and exegetical scholarship around the council and its many documents to allow a more robust and nuanced articulation of the council to emerge. Now, it probably was unrealistic to have said then, we're going to wait 40 years before we start this. But you can't help but wonder what would happen if that project were undertaken now. You know, and it's why I think a lot of people think we need a new fundamental revisioning of the Code of Canon Law.
Now, one other area you brought up, I guess this was in a book by Rita Ferroni, but comparing the rite of Christiation initiation for adults, which very successful story out of Vatican II, with the rite of penance. Right. Maybe you could talk about that.
That was part of the larger story of this mixed bag of the institutionalization of the liturgical reform. And so I was telling the remarkable story, really, of the concilium, this commission of bishops and worldwide renowned liturgical scholars who were trying to take the liturgical vision of the council and apply it to the reform of the liturgical books and practices of the church. And they did important work, but as their work became sort of reattached with the Curia, first when they were folded back into the Congregation for Divine Worship, and then in 1975 when Divine Worship and Discipline of the Sacraments were combined, what you get is what Piero Marini calls the curialization of the Reform. And it led to a certain unevenness. One of the great strengths of the liturgical Reform kind of celebrated at the Council was its willingness to draw on top-notch historical scholarship. Well, the RCIA, though it's not perfect in any way, in many ways, did, I think, a very good job of drawing on solid historical scholarship to retrieve some important neglected elements in the early church's catechumenal process. When you look at the rite of penance, that scholarship was there. Major work had been done on that. Karl Rahner had written a major work on the history of the rite of penance. But there was, frankly, a kind of failure of nerve, an unwillingness to really take seriously what historical scholarship was saying about a renewed celebration of penance. And so we get a hybrid rite that's certainly an improvement on the preconciliar form, but I think falls far short of what the best of liturgical scholarship had hoped for.
And one example of that is like the communal nature of penance, and that has certainly not been emphasized quite as much as some of the Council Fathers perhaps would have argued for.
No, I think that's exactly right. The primary form still is the one-on-one encounter between the confessor and the penitent. And, I don't want to deny the legitimacy of auricular confession as it developed in the tradition, but there's just no way to look at the ancient tradition of the Church and get to the point where one-on-one auricular confession should be the norm for the celebration of the sacrament. And in fact, it still is right now.
Maybe we could transition to kind of the third part of your talk, which is where do we go from here? You can explain the two approaches that have been proposed. One is, as you put it, kind of a renewed determination to fulfill the promise of the Council, so kind of focusing on these issues that we just talked about. The other is to kind of turn outward and say, okay, enough
right.
with looking
right.
and to evangelize.
Right. Well, this is of course part of the sort of the contested character of the reception of the Council. One sort of narrative of the reception of the Council that's getting a lot of play today in more conservative circles is a narrative that goes like this. Well, yes, certainly the Council called forth important internal ecclesiastical reforms, and in the first decades after the Council, we spent a whole lot of time doing those kind of internal ecclesiastical reforms. But let's not forget the fact that the Council was as much about mission as it was about internal reform and renewal, and that perhaps the time has come to set aside all of our concerns about rearranging church furniture and focus on the real work of the Church, which is its mission in the world. Cardinal George has said this, but you find a lot of other people saying this as well. It's a way to say they're still celebrating the Council, but they want to redirect the focus. Now, I don't want to completely dismiss what they're suggesting here. It does seem to me sometimes that we have not given as much attention as we should to the role of mission in the life of the Church, in the way in which Ad Gentes, the decree on the missionary life of the Church, said that the Church is missionary in its very nature. And there's a lot more to be done there. And it's even perhaps true that we've spent a lot of time thinking about the role of the laity in the life of the Church and lay ministry and consultation of the laity and those things, and not enough about the laity's obligations to live the gospel in the world. Having said that, I think it's a mistake to imagine that you can ever put one thing aside and start the other. So if you think about the work of ecclesiastical reform and renewal, if you think of what the Decree on Ecumenism said, that insofar as, in Article 6, insofar as the Church is a human institution, it will always be in need of reform and renewal. I would argue that that kind of reform and renewal should not be opposed to Church mission. In fact, they go hand in hand. Because the truth is, if we don't do reform and renewal, our witness to the world's compromised. And I suggested that we see that with the clerical sexual abuse controversy. To the extent that we're not just talking about the scandal, and it's a real one, of individual priests molesting children, but a larger institutional scandal that has to do with episcopal malfeasance, reassigning priests, and so on, what we're talking about is a structural failure or an institutional dysfunction. Now, if you want to speak about the Church's mission in the world, you've got to recognize our capacity to give a faithful witness to the gospel in the world is compromised when what the world sees is that kind of institutional dysfunction. So an emphasis on church mission may need more focus, but it has to go hand in hand with the ongoing need for reform and renewal within the life and the structures of the church. They can't be opposed to one another.
Now, finally, maybe we can talk about the idea of a Vatican III. This was the subject you mentioned in your talk, probably what drew people in. What is the argument to be made, the pros, the cons for a Vatican III, or as you suggested, maybe we'll call it a Manila I. We have it somewhere else.
Right. Well, the arguments would be this, that first of all, to some extent, every ecumenical council is a kind of transitional council. It's a council that's moving from one set of concerns to another, and it's occupied very much by the questions of the day. And Vatican II is exactly that. There is a particular set of questions that preoccupied the council. And you can see this at multiple levels. So if you want to ask about church structure, as we just said, the council spent a tremendous amount of time on the episcopate. It did that with good reason because it recognized Vatican I focused on the papacy, was suspended because of the Franco-Prussian War, didn't get a chance to address the episcopate. So Vatican I spends a fair amount of time focusing on a theology of the bishop's office, all right? It does not treat the priesthood in nearly the detail that it treats the episcopate, and its treatment of the permanent diaconate is almost non-existent. And like manner, there's virtually no consideration of lay ministry. Now, I'm not faulting the council. It dealt with the pressing question of the time. But at some point, you have to recognize appealing to the council has its limits. There are issues and questions facing our church today that Vatican II is not going to help us much with. If we want to ask questions about the permanent diaconate, and it's not a global phenomenon, but it's a major phenomenon in the American church. If we want to ask questions about lay ecclesial ministry, huge numbers of lay ecclesial ministers in our church today, Vatican II's not going to help us a lot. Those weren't that council's questions. So at some point, even as we continue to strive to implement the vision of the council, we have to recognize that the church, as we're now almost 50 years removed from the council, we'll be celebrating the 50th anniversary of the opening of the council in 2012. At some point, we have to recognize we may be facing a set of questions that requires a new council. And yes, I was somewhat tongue-in-cheek saying perhaps it won't be Vatican III, perhaps it'll be Kinshasa I or Manila I. And that was my way of saying that one of the new questions facing the council, even though Father Karl Rahner said that the great gift of Vatican II is that we finally developed a consciousness of ourselves as a Weltkirche, a world church. That may have been true at some extent, but it's really true now, and it's much more true now than it was 40 years ago. One way in which a council can acknowledge the foregrounding of the global consciousness of the church would be, in fact, to conduct a council where the church is growing most dramatically, in a place like Africa or Asia or some parts of Latin America. And I think that in itself would be a tremendous statement about the need of the council to address some pretty significantly new questions.
And the cons of having another council at this point, is it perhaps too early? You know, we're just 50 years removed from Vatican II?
Well, there's some practical cons. I mean, one of them is we've got, as I suggested to you, the scholarship about Vatican II is just now coming into maturity. There is still tremendous work being done that is trying to work with archival documents that we're only now as scholars having access to. You know, the Bologna School that produced this monumental five-volume history of Vatican II, you know, that the last volume was only published within the last couple of years. And that's certainly not the final word in responsible, in-depth historical scholarship. So you could make the case that we're still trying to appropriate what the heck Vatican II was about. And that would argue for holding off before you turn to a new council, spend more time taking advantage of that scholarship. However, the history of the church shows that oftentimes the best way to receive the fruits of one council is to have another. And so Nicaea, the fruits of Nicaea are ultimately received at the Council of Constantinople. So that, you know, that again becomes then an argument for having a new council. I think the biggest and most compelling argument for not having a new council in our present moment is not a question of whether there are new issues that need to be addressed, because I think there are. It's that the truth is, whether one celebrates it or one laments it, the church's leadership, Vatican leadership, and even Episcopal leadership in many parts of the world is in a very cautionary mode. And I don't think that's a mode inclined to invite the kind of serious ecclesial reflection about the questions of our time. And so I think there's a legitimate fear that if we were to have a council now, It would not be a council oriented towards addressing new questions. It would end up being a council trying to reaffirm a Catholic identity that some church leaders think is in question. And if all we're going to do is to have a council to reassert Catholic identity, ironically, Pope John the 23rd said the same thing in his opening address to Vatican II. He said, look, if all we're going to do is reiterate church teaching, why have a new council? I think the same argument is true now. And in our church leadership, current church leadership, there's a real likelihood that that's what a new council would look like. Simply a chance to reaffirm Catholic identity and a real resistance to pressing pastoral questions.
Well, Professor Richard Glardy, we want to thank you very much for speaking with us.
It's been my pleasure.